I thought in this first hour of our program, and by the way, it's a three-hour program. We've got a great program in the second hour. I'll explain it a little bit later on. But I thought we'd start with looking at the theme of innovation. And Gary, somebody that you are familiar with, and we are delighted to have in studio with us, is Professor Jeff DeGraff, who is with he's titled informally, I think, the Dean of Innovation, who is with the, he's a professor of management and organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. And since that is your alma mater, I'll let you introduce him further.
Sure, I absolutely will. Well, while I was there, Jeff wasn't. He came about 4 years later, so he's just a youngster, really. Don't let the photo on the website fool you.
It's a good one.
Jeff, informally, it's the title is Dean of Innovation, but you have been preaching innovation and teaching innovation for a long time, and it's about time everybody else is now jumping on the bandwagon and saying, yes, what I'm doing is innovative. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Hey, you've done this for so long. You've helped big companies become more innovative. You've helped entrepreneurs become more innovative. Tell us a little bit about this new program that you've launched recently, and that's the Certified Professional Innovator.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
Well, for years, I'm in my 25th year here at Michigan. When I first got to Michigan, nobody anywhere really taught anything around innovation, really in the way that we would do it today. There was Michael Ray at Stanford and myself. And what was interesting was innovation was taught basically out of a textbook. And it talked about things that had maybe happened 10 years ago. Cases, the Harvard Business Review cases were typically 3 or 4 years old. And of course, innovation isn't about the past, it's about the future.
Yeah.
And what makes innovation so radically different than everything else is it's the only time-based form of value. Now, that's a clever way of saying, you know, an innovation goes sour like milk over time. And if you don't believe that, think about all the stuff you bought for your kids at the at the Apple store this year. And, you know, the stuff you bought last year is all, you know, junk, right? So there's this incredible cycle. And the second problem with time that you have with innovation is it happens in the future and there is no data on the future. Mm-hmm. So one of the big problems when you try and teach innovation or teach somebody how to be an innovator is that you get stuck in the planning cycle, and it's the classic mistake companies make. It's the classic mistake people make. Have you ever been to the meeting about the meeting? Have you ever seen the report about the report? Yeah, this is the problem. So
you're gonna pull together a bunch of people in a meeting, and you're gonna say, okay, now act serendipitously and come up with something innovative.
You
right?
got it.
And
so
what
I did about 10 years ago, in order to get students to do better, started with students as I built this lab in Ann Arbor along with my friend Dick Hayworth of the Hayworth Furniture Company in Holland, Michigan. And the lab was basically to teach students with a see one, do one, teach one technique. So the object is we'd work on real projects. They'd first see the old masters work on them, and then, you know, the young kids would get a chance to work on them, and we'd give them a little advice, and then eventually they'd become the people, the stewards of the community. And this is where a lot of these innovation groups and actual projects came out of Ann Arbor. So a lot of them came out of this lab. It's called the Innovatrium.
Can you give some examples just to help us?
Well, I think the three big ones that people know about are we worked on a project called Imagination Breakthrough very early on before we actually had the lab, and it's now known to everybody as Eco-Imagination. It's General Electric's $15 billion green, really started the green movement, I think, for all practical purposes. The second is we worked on something for NBC television, local television, that through a number of failures, and we'll talk about why the failure cycle is so important, became Hulu.
Oh my goodness.
And,
A third one is we worked on a project at Coca-Cola called C2. And after a number of permutations, became Coke Zero.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so,
yes.
So the object is we're not inventing anything. What we're doing is connecting a lot of dots. We're figuring out how to move it through the system. We're figuring out how to get to scale, how to monetize, how to make money.
Now, excuse me, Jeff, because that's an important point when you say we're not inventing something. Because I think people sometimes think of innovation and then invention in the same breath.
Yeah.
But it's not.
They're not. And in fact, that's part of, I think, what my contribution to the field was. 25 years ago, I had some very radical ideas, and I'm part of a group that developed a model called the Competing Values Framework. In my field, it's known as the Innovation Genome, and it's often used to predict share prices. So this group that I started with developed this general model, and then I developed the specific model. But what my model said is that innovation is not tied to a hard, lumpy object. innovation is actually tied to any form of useful novelty. And what I early on did was I took my definition of innovation from an old codger that a lot of us who are old enough remember, Marshall McLuhan.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if any of your listeners remember old Marshall. I used to go up to the University of Toronto. And McLuhan said four things that I think are really true. The first thing he said is, an innovation has to make something better or new. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it can be better and new like Google. You know, Larry was one of our students at Michigan,
right?
The founder of Google.
Larry Page.
And, you know, so, okay, it makes searching, you know, better.
Okay.
The second thing is it has to destroy something. And this is what people often forget. An innovation has to eliminate something. So I want you to think about every brokerage out there and what Charles Schwab did to them in the early 1990s, right? So a real innovation, if it has any relevant speed or magnitude, and I want your listeners to remember those two words, speed and magnitude, because not all innovations are the same. Some innovations have huge magnitude and have very fast speeds, like miracle drugs, and some have very low magnitude, like you're improving how many songs you could put on your iPhone, and you know, so they're completely different.
Now, Jeff, just a moment. When you said destroy something, am I thinking, like, for instance, when the iPhone came out,
right?
It was quantitatively different than anything that had come beforehand, and it really destroyed the palm in many ways, and a lot of stuff that had gone before.
Yeah, actually, I think it's funny. I was an advisor for years to Apple. I think the iPhone actually wasn't a category killer in the technology itself. It was in the entire ecosystem that was put together.
Ah.
So your iPad, your phone, how it all related to what was in the cloud. And I was somebody who met Jobs when I was very early. When I was 25, I was on his advisory team when he's being pushed out the first time. And it was called Applied Integrated Systems. It's hard for your listeners to remember that there was a decade before we had an internet. Mm-hmm. And some of us were, you know, that's what we did, and we were screwing around with that. But what was interesting was very early on, Jobs had an idea of what this ecosystem could be. And it did destroy, the ecosystem did destroy a lot of things, including a lot of phone companies. I want you to remember a lot of countries like India were way behind in network technology. And instead of building a lot of twisted pair of line, they basically built cell towers and jumped in front of what we have here in America.
Exactly. And I understand that's what we have, like in Korea and Japan, many other places.
And you Vietnam, have, they don't even have a wired phone.
But you have these wireless systems with incredible speeds. Everybody's connecting at incredible speeds.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have to go through the copper revolution.
Absolutely. So that's the destroy. That's the second point. The third is, it has to make us want to return to something we feel we've lost. And that could be everything from going to the bookstore, where you feel like you're back in college when you're in Barnes & Noble, or it could be taking Viagra. I mean, it could be any of those things, right? But McLuhan really knew, and there's really a market for what people want. So, when I was a kid, I always thought we were going to live like the Jetsons. But most of us really want to live in a cottage and be safe and, go fishing on the weekend, right?
Ain't that the truth?
And the fourth thing McLuhan said, which I think is the most profound thing he said about innovation, which I agree with all these points, is over time, an innovation reverses into its opposite. Do you remember when email was going to set you free?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and it's done just the opposite, as you say.
Okay, so that last one was, innovations will eventually revert to their opposite.
Yes.
They'll have an unintended consequence,
perhaps. Think about things like drones.
Oh, now that is a very, very good point. Professor Jeff DeGraff, we're going to continue in just a moment talking more about innovation here as we continue on this first hour. Perhaps at the beginning of 2015, if we still are close to that, this is our second program of the new year with the Internet Advisor. It's fitting that we talk a little bit about the future and about two events that have taken place, one just finishing up, one about to start, that is the Consumer Electronics Show and the North American International Auto Show about to start, that have focused on innovation within the car industry, but in so many, many other ways. And so we're delighted that we have with us right now Professor Jeff DeGraff, who is with the Ross School of Business, where he is a professor of management and organizations at the University of Michigan, been there for a quarter century.
That's right. And unofficially the dean of innovation. And actually, if you go to our website, you can link off to jeffdegraff.com and learn a lot more about him. But, you know, when we were talking last segment, Jeff, you had mentioned the failure cycle. and then we never had the chance to talk about it. What is that, and why is failure so important to innovation?
Well, because we don't have data on the future, and people do get stuck in the planning cycle, you have to get momentum. And because we don't have any data on the future, we have to hedge our bets. So I don't want you to think about this like a financial sense of just managing risk. I want you to think about this like you're fishing, mm-hmm. right? You go to a new lake, you've never been there. How do you know what's in the lake? How do you know what's biting? So you put a bunch of different lures on, you throw a lot of different bait, and very quickly you begin to figure out what they're hitting. Mm-hmm. And then as you get smarter and smarter, you start to optimize. So the failure cycle is important, and this is why venture capitalists give a little bit of money to a lot of people at the beginning. This is what we call the angel phaser. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to get is what's called a churn rate, a burn rate. So they're trying to very quickly figure out what works and what doesn't work mm-hmm. and why. And here's the key. The key is never fall in love with the solution. Mm. Fall in love with the challenge, because the solution is going to change over time. Think about it. Version 1, version 2, version 3.
Right. Sure.
Very seldom do you get it right the first time. And if you did, you're either lucky, right? And your luck is going to run out at some particular point, right? Or you know, you've got some magical powers. But for the most part, serial entrepreneurs and serial innovators always hedge at the beginning.
You know, it's interesting, Jeff, because Microsoft is often maligned for having, you know, putting out something that eventually has to be redone again and again and again, right now within Windows 8, soon to be Windows 10, which, personally, I'm using it. I think it's going to be a wonderful improvement on it. But they've been maligned because they haven't had it done right the first time around. But they stick to it, and eventually they do come up with
a pretty
good product.
I think the reason people push back on Microsoft, and I think it's fair, is that as companies get larger and larger, the process of innovation gets heavier and heavier and heavier. Mm-hmm. There's things like portfolio management, stage gating systems, and how you manage metrics. There's a whole I write a lot of books about this. But the issue is sometimes the weight of the process gets heavier than the experimentation itself. Right, so this is going to be one of the big keys. So the challenge when you do this is you want to help have people go through the failure cycle without taking a lot of risk. And the way to do it is very simple. First of all, people have to come up with a high-quality target. Most of the people who innovate try and boil the ocean and extract gold. You know, and it's, I get those all the time. I've got the next miracle. No, you don't. No, just calm down. Two, innovation is not produced through alignment. It's produced through constructive conflict. That's why innovation happens in areas around the world that are the most diverse areas. So it's not an amateur sport. It requires deep and diverse domain expertise. So I live in this little city of Ann Arbor with 102,000 people, but it's the most educated zip code in the world. Everybody has a different area. So they're not amateurs, but they don't agree. It's conflict. Right? It's pushing and shoving that creates the new idea. Third, you have to take multiple shots on goal. That's the failure cycle. Are you willing to do that? Right? Most people hate failure. And unfortunately, those of us who've kind of succeeded at this, a lot of us growing up were you know, screw-ups. A lot of us were screw-ups, including myself.
There's hope for me yet.
Yeah. My son, who's 16, talking about the show today, and I was excited to have you on, and we were talking about, and he mentioned Thomas Edison.
Yeah.
And he said, well, Edison always, you know, he failed right up until the very last time. I said, that's it. He kept going until
and he
that
was
very
and
last time.
As all innovators right. are, because either, you know, you could say somebody's a visionary in one breath and in the other breath say he's a liar. He was a liar. He was a total liar. Edison said he was going to have an incandescent light bulb in 6 weeks. That would be like saying now we're going to have cold fusion in 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. He knew he didn't know how to do it. He pilfered all kinds of patents that had been out there. He was notoriously manipulative. But in 3 years, he came up with an incandescent light bulb. So this whole idea of looking at the future, whoever looks at the future is going to seem like a kook to some degree. Well, the final part that you have to have is you got to get smarter. You got to learn from your experience and experiments. And the problem is most people who fail don't get any smarter. You know the guy who's on his fourth marriage and he's never, you know, he's the, you know, he's never any smarter.
Now, let's talk about innovators. Who do you see in the current horizon who do you think are the key innovators of our generation right now?
Well, I think everybody talks about Elon Musk and
he was
and
in
Tesla
my mind right away,
and SpaceX, and I think that's fair. I actually think people are looking the wrong direction for who the great innovators are. I think the great innovators are kind of in three categories. One of my favorites is the X Prize, and seeing people in places around the world that you normally wouldn't expect great innovators to come from.
The X Prize was to create a vehicle that would go to the moon?
Well, that was the first one, but there are also things like how to create an inexpensive oven in sub-Saharan Africa, how to basically eliminate certain diseases that the large farmers aren't looking at. So they can become very very simple or very sophisticated, but what I love about it is there's a lot of places in the world where people don't have access to the kinds of technologies and capital that we do in the United States, but they're wonderfully imaginative. So the one thing I want everybody to get is people are innovative everywhere. That is not a birthright to Americans.
Okay, good.
Millions and millions of miles on Delta alone, and I could tell you, I see some of the most amazing stuff in hovels and in little corners of the world.
Do you mean they really don't have to be a certified professional innovator?
Yes, they don't have to be one. But it's good if they are one. How about that?
So tell us about this program, because it's a certification an innovator?
The big thing for me was there's a lot of people who were line managers, or they were running a restaurant, or they're a regional manager. They were never taught about innovation when they came up through the system. And so I literally get thousands of these emails a year. What can you do for me? I read your book, something like that. And what I ended up doing was with the School of Engineering at the University of Michigan, I built a program with 14 modules, and it's like the Khan Academy. It's me going on for about 15 minutes about things like how do you actually build a measurement system for innovation? How do you actually build a development system for innovation? And I built it so that you can do it while you're on the subway or working out, because you don't want to sit and listen to me ramble on about this stuff. And then the idea is you have to be assessed, and you get a real project that you're going to bring in to my lab, the Innovatrium, and for 2 days, we're going to do what we'd do if you were General Electric or Apple. We're going to jumpstart it. So the project, you actually have to do it. You have to run a project. For the next 90 days, myself or the junior faculty or somebody from my lab is going to be coaching these teams, and that's what happens.
So you create a space, like a maker space in some senses, where they can bring their ideas in. And you had the wherewithal, the machinery, et cetera, to make it happen.
Yeah, that's where all these innovations started. I put this building together a decade ago. And what's interesting about this is it's not the building. It's the community that you build.
That's right.
It's the people. And the final part of that is it really is this deep, diverse domain expertise where you're getting this conflict. The final part is they have to present the idea. It has to be significantly better and new. It has to have magnitude and speed. And if they succeed, the University of Michigan gives them a certificate from the University of Michigan. You put a sticker on your helmet saying, the University of Michigan says I can actually do this kind of stuff. It's the same kind of things they do with surgeons, and the same kind of things that they do with anybody who's going on in developing their education and adding the certifications to their education.
What value does that have been in the marketplace?
Well, if I'm a regional manager and all of a sudden an innovation has been pushed down into the line functions, this is a big thing that's happened in the last 10 years. It's gotten out of the R&D lab. Now you've got to figure out how to manage your warehouse with robotics and big data. And right. So the notion is that person is looking for a competitive advantage against the other 100 people who are out there who are the middle-aged managers trying to look for a way to have a leg up or something better than the other guy has. And that's what I think a lot of these are. And a lot of them are also engineers who are in things like the software business, and it's all compiler code and they want to do something different. They want somebody to recognize that they can actually create new types of software, new types of solutions.
We're talking with Jeff Dean, by the way. Who was he in?
Jeff DeGraff.
Jeff DeGraff, pardon
that's
me.
That's right.
The Dean of Innovation. That's how I get mixed up. Professor of Management and Organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. I want to get back to the innovators again. Now, you mentioned Elon Musk. Anybody else that struck you? Now, maybe from one of those hovels you visited, somebody that struck you as...
Yes, I got to meet a young doctor in India who was doing cataract surgery. And he was doing cataract surgery, which in America takes about 2 hours for somebody to do.
I had this year, both eyes.
I met a man who was doing them in 18 minutes, and he was doing them for $200 a piece.
Whoa!
Amazing stuff like this. I gave when the Affordable Care Act came out under pressure from a couple of my colleagues, I gave my TED Talk at the Kennedy Center in D.C., with Francis Collins, who cracked the genome, and Michael Porter, and the Surgeon General, and everybody else. And one of the things I did with my talk, I think, was really radical. I invited four clients, like Google, et cetera, to show what their innovations are. And what's happening is young people are doing physicals with an iPhone, and young people are developing decalcifying nutraceutical drugs. And these are people that are not famous yet. They will be.
All right. We're talking again with Jeff DeGraff, the Dean of Innovation. When we come back, I have two things I want him to apply. Welcome to the Internet Advisor, Foster Brown co-host, along with Gary Baker, Ed Rudell, Kel Carson, kind of silent partners now. We're all gobbling up and listening to the conversation going on here, making applications, I'm sure, Ed, in your head for innovations.
No, I'm just taking notes.
Ed is a tinkerer, and in his garage, I'm sure things are going on. Same thing with Cal as well. Jeff DeGraff with us. He is a Dean of Innovation, informal title, but professionally, he is the Professor of Management and Organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Now, we've been talking kind of generally about the notion of innovation, Jeff. I want to apply it, if we could, to two things that came out of CES and get a sense of where you think these things might go. And if they're really innovations, Intel at CES introduced something called the Curie module. It's a tiny little thing that essentially is a CPU, which is, the brain. Am I right? It's called the kind of the brain of the computer.
Well, it has a CPU in there. It's about the size of a dime or a nickel.
Yeah.
It's not very large at all.
Tiny. It has Bluetooth LE. It has a built-in accelerometer. And it has a gyroscope, so it can tell you about speed and about the height it has and where it is, essentially. The notion is that this coin-like little thing can be placed in just about anything and essentially turn the Internet of Things, anything, into a sentient being, in a sense, knowing where it is and what's going on. Do you think this is an innovation, true innovation, and where do you think it can go?
First of all, no, I don't. I don't think it's I think it's an innovation, but I think it's a relatively moderate, not a radical innovation. Mm-hmm. I think what it will drive will be a radical innovation. So let me see if I can separate the two things. Obviously, one of the things everybody talks about is the Internet of Things, where your washer talks to your dryer and your car talks to your thermostat at your house. And that is a foregone conclusion, and a lot of organizations have already built that in. In order for that to work, there has to be this kind of cascading, connect to everything, pervasive bit of technology. And there are some uber aggregators out there. These are the Googles of the world and the Amazons and the Apples of the world and a handful of other companies people have never heard of that hold everything together. And that's what people mostly think about when they think about this kind of technology. But what I want people to think about is what this allows younger people to do, particularly millennials, who don't recognize institutions, who have opted out of institutions. Mm-hmm. It allows them to connect horizontally. So I want you to think about this for a minute. I want you to think about what technologies typically do is they make things go better, cheaper, and faster into the hub-and-spoke system that exists.
Okay.
But what if they allow you to go better, cheaper, faster outside of the hub-and-spoke system? What happens if you can opt out? Now, I want you to think about that. I'm not trying to be too radical here, but think about this. You know, one of the big things that goes on right now in finance is what's called flash trading, where people build black boxes and they're having high speeds, and they're able to trade faster than you and I can trade. So what they get is they get to change the share price, and they get to collect whatever the float that's left on that share price that you and I should have collected, right? This is how the rich get richer, right? This is what they do. But now I want you to imagine that people aren't trading stocks on the exchanges. I want you to imagine that people have handheld devices that are infinitely more sophisticated, faster, courtesy of Intel, than anything that we've got out there right now, and that, in fact, they can process data horizontally between each other and trade stocks between each other without going to any exchange. I want this is like Bitcoins.
Bitcoin came to my mind right away.
I want you to imagine that the more power you put in someone's hand, the more they don't have to be on the grid. So what people in my area are thinking about is they're thinking about how it all goes on the grid. Well, I want you to think about how it might not need to go to the grid. And that's both a very powerful thing because it's very freeing, but it's also a very scary thing because it allows a lot of places for people to create mischief in this world.
You know, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. We are going to be talking in the next hour. Rick Broyd is going to come on, our gadget guy. We're going to be talking about Sling TV, just named the best of CES. And it has a potential for doing that same thing of stepping outside of this whole, cable companies and network TVs and everything else and creating something that's absolutely different.
That's the difference between boomers, my generation, and young people. I want to tell you something. I was recently on this think tank with Condoleezza Rice and Joe Coughlin of the MIT Age Lab. And it was really interesting because we were talking about retirement. So if you see the Prudential commercials where they put up the purple dots, that's the result of that. But one of the things that Coughlin laid out that was really interesting is he said in 2013, over half of all live births to women under the age of 30 are outside of marriage. Young people aren't marrying. The fastest growing religion in people under 30 in the United States, plus 18, is atheism. They don't believe in God. right? In general, I'm not saying, and I'm not trying to be judgmental. Third, when we ask them, the Pew Charitable Trust, what they want to do for a living, they don't want to come and work and make a lot of money. They want to be self-actualized. They want to, you know, they want to save the environment. They're what we call post-capitalist economy. So why is that important? Well, an old guy like me, you know, marriage, capitalism, and, you know, my belief system is pretty important to me.
Right.
They have opted out of a lot of institutions in a very fundamental way. They have a very horizontal view of the world. Right. This is very important. They don't see race the same way. They don't see orientation. They have wonderful values. Real. So this is not to be controversial or judgmental that way. This is to say you're looking at a group of people who have opted out of the vertical world. So their worldview is, how do we connect horizontally? Right. This is why when you look at who thought WikiLeaks was a good idea, they're all younger. Right. That's what most of the data says.
Yeah.
And those of us who are older thought this was a really bad thing. Right. We're very upset about it. So what's been interesting to me is these kinds of technologies, like what Intel has. Traditionally, people in my age group are thinking it's all going to make everything talk together. It's all going to be better. Our Facebook's going to talk to our refrigerator, and we're going to know whether granny's out of food. We need to go over to her house and feed her. Right. But for this other generation, I think it offers radical possibilities.
Wow. Fascinating. I'm looking at these two guys, Ed and Cal, who have children, I think, maybe in the millennial range.
Mm-hmm.
Ed, am I right on that in terms of when they were born, around the turn of the century?
Yeah, they were born in, what, 91, 93?
Okay. Would that be the millennials?
Millennials.
Yeah, okay. Sure. They're millennials.
That's what we're talking about. And Cal, you've got a daughter who is 20-something.
Yeah, unfortunately, she's 25. But yeah, and I hear what he's talking about, and it really makes the world weird for us older guys, because it's like that whole Google approach. On our floor at work, they've redone that floor completely. And it used to be everyone would be in a cube. You'd have walls where you couldn't see each other. You did your business, and it was a vertical society, just like he says. Now, they went on, 3/4 of our floor has all glass cubes. You can see each other. They've taken out 1/3 of all the cubes, and they put in what they call collaboration areas, where they go in and they sit on couches and high back tables.
Yep, and they wear fuzzy slippers and couches.
They've
Come
got
on.
Lava lights. They've got couches. It's just a
weird looking
place.
Well, we got the old timers here going on, don't we?
and it's a weird world. It is a very weird world,
old
because
man-itis.
You look at it and say, what the heck's going on?
Free cookies and pop, you know, come on.
Yeah.
And they all got ribbons. You got to add that one. That's what all old timers do. And they all got ribbons.
You know, Jeff, how do you teach these wildcats?
Well, that's why I built the lab. That's why I built the Innovatrium, because I think they have a lot to teach us. I think that their form of innovation is radically different than ours, in that it's more socially oriented, more value oriented, less goal oriented. Mm. There's always an upside and a downside. They're much more democratic than our age group. And there's a lot of research on this. Mm-hmm. Our age group is really meritocracy, really based on goals. We competed for everything. Their age group, it's a different world, and for good reason. They saw that the things that we built maybe are not lasting. You know, they're not particularly thrilled with the world that we've left them with, right?
I think we actually destroyed the world for them, because it's during the time that Gary came up, those were the times where, you know, you're in competition, you're first, second, third, and then that was it. You just, you know, you were done. These kids are coming up in a world where everyone gets a ribbon, everyone gets a medal, and it's just ridiculous. They don't taste the, you know, it isn't the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. They've got, everything is just in the middle.
But they're great, they're fluent in technology in the way that we are not, and they're going to use it in ways that we never thought about using.
Oh, man.
Right.
Folks, you have just heard the discussion that's on the cusp of the future.
We could do another two-hour show, man, on that alone.
Jeff DeGraff, thank you so much for being with us. It has been a ball having
Thanks
you.
For having me, everybody.
Thank you,
and
Jeff.
By the way, you should go to internetadvisor.net, our homepage, and when you see Dean of Innovation, right under there, Jeff's name is highlighted. Click on that, and it'll take you to his website, and you can find out much more about what he's involved in. Hey, there is a second of our 3 hours coming up, and in that one, we're going to be talking with Rick Broyd about some of the gadgets that came out of CES, and also with Paul Eisenstein about the upcoming North American International Auto Show. Two examples